and they are spending an extra $1 trillion on technology this year and getting rid of as many people as fast as possible in pursuing infinite improvement in efficiency only. And I think they are leaving a hole that is a million miles wide for financial services people who help their customers by being incredibly technologically savvy, but also being savvy about who the person is that they're serving.
Podcasting from WealthWave Studios in Johns Creek, Georgia, this is Leadership Now, the official vision and strategy podcast of WealthWave.
Today's guest is one of the top-selling business authors and top speakers of all time. He's spoken to our company three different times in our annual conventions over the years. So today, I am so excited to welcome to Leadership Now, Tom Peters. Tom, thanks for taking the time to be with us today.
Hey, it is my great pleasure to be with you.
Well, you know, I first met you back in the late 90s, and you just immediately became one of my business heroes. And your words and your thoughts from our times together have helped me to shape our business into what we have today. And I just listened to what you said so clearly because I felt like you had a handle on looking into the future, and all I had to do was listen. So how would you describe what you do?
Well, and obviously we can go wherever you want to go with this, but not to contradict you, I would argue at some level I've got a handle on the past. I taught back in the 80s a two-day seminar for YPO people, and one of the people there was a guy named Manny Garcia, who was either the second or the third or the fourth largest Burger King franchisee. He owns South Florida, among other things. And at the end of the 2 days, we had people do a little debrief, and, you know, most of them said, oh, it was a nice 2 days, and I learned a lot. And Manny gets up, and I'd spent time with him, and I loved the guy. And he said, well, he said, 2 days of my time is a pretty big deal, and I learned absolutely nothing new. You know, at which point I wished that, you know, New York had had an open carry law, because I would have shot myself. And then he said, but it was the best 2 days I've spent in my training life ever. He said it was a blinding flash of the obvious. He said it was reminding me of the things that we all know we ought to do all the time. And in the heat of the battle and the mess and so on, we forget to do them. As you well know, one of the things that we put into In Search of Excellence, which to me is still the bedrock of the bedrock, and I think you can do it in different ways in the high-tech era, was managing by wandering around, getting out of the office, getting in touch with the real people. And, you know, as I like to describe it, nothing I have ever written requires more than a second grade education. But the point of my new book is that I think these basics, in fact, are the best defense and offense and way to deal with the technology change. But, you know, you and I had a little preliminary talk about your Jesuit training and so on. People first is where it's at, where it's always been at, for many reasons. But, I'm a real old guy. I had my 75th birthday. And when you get to be an old man or an old woman, and you were a manager or a leader, the only thing worth remembering is the people you helped. I mean, you know, I'm totally in favor of becoming a millionaire or a billionaire or whatever else it is. I'm a good capitalist pig, but at the end of the day, it's all about helping people grow from the 19-year-old to the 49-year-old to what have you. And I think you and I share that, I won't call it a bias, we share that value to a pretty extreme extent.
So I think what you're saying is if you really pay attention to your history and where you've been and how things went, and apply against that whatever you did in response to it, that may be one of the best ways of looking forward and figuring out what to do as you look to the future.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you know, it's I made a smart aleck remark on Twitter a while back, and somebody was going gaga, and this was before the pedophile stuff or what have you going gaga over Elon Musk changing the world, which to some significant extent I think he is.
Right.
And I said, well, you know, I'm a great admirer of Elon Musk. I admire him almost as much as a truly excellent second grade teacher who changes the lives of 19 kids who she begins to deal with at the beginning of the year and 9 months later sends out with a big boost. And again, I would say that that developing people thing, whether they're seven-year-old second graders or whether it's an executive who you run into who's 53, is that's the beginning and the end of the story. And you know, as again, as I think we totally agree, and guess what, hint hint, it's the best way to make money.
Well, I totally agree. You know, it, as you know, we're in the financial services industry, and I think you, with your new book, you make a renewed call to excellence in the context of, I think you call it data-driven and dehumanized world we live in today. And so your Excellence Dividend book says that putting people first is even more relevant today than it was when you did In Search of Excellence. So what do you think gives companies the best chance to be great these days?
I am 100% in favor of adopting and using as much new technology as you can. But there are some asterisks. And this is a long way from financial services, but let me give you one tiny example. People have said to me, you know, what's your ideal job? And I said, well, my ideal job is to run a 53-person housekeeping department in whatever that translates into, 150-room hotel. And I chose the number 53, and this is a couple years old, maybe it's changed, because 53 is the number of players on the active duty roster of a National Football League team. And now I live in the greater Boston area. I grew up with the San Francisco 49ers, but now it's all Patriots, Patriots, Patriots.
Right.
And so I'm going to walk in as a new manager of my 53-person housekeeping department. And I'm going to say, and you know who those people will be. They've got two jobs, 25% of them are single moms, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm going to say, when I look at you 53 people, what I see is the New England Patriots of housekeeping. You are a group of human beings whose goal in life is to grow and be of service to others. And what I believe, and I really talk about this a lot in the book, and again, this is not criticizing the basic notion, is I said, my 53 fired up people with two jobs, single moms, etc., are going to beat the heck out of the housekeeping department that was hired entirely by algorithm. The algorithm hired people are going to beat my people for the first 6 months with productivity, but over the 4-year period, I'm going to beat the heck out of them in terms of performance and in terms of the development of people. So I think we use these tools to assist us, and particularly in the world of financial services. You may remember my lead example in the new book is Metro Bank, which used to be Commerce Bank in the U.S., and then Vernon Hill, who started it, started a bank in the U.K. that was wildly successful. Commerce was wildly successful. It was a startup, and he sold it to TD Bank for $8.5 billion, which is a reasonably good indicator of success. And his whole thing, he exploits technology, but he says, I don't want them at the ATM. I want them in the branches. I want them where I can help them. I want them where I can sell them business. I want them where my team can really show off its commitment to the lives of each of our customers. And so I genuinely believe you can have your cake and eat it too. But I think it's going to be a pretty calorie-free cake if it just says technology is the be-all and the end-all. It's not. It's an assistant. It's not the game.
Well, your tagline, your book said, meeting the tech tide with work that wows and jobs that last. And I think that's what everybody's looking for. They're trying to figure out, as we go into the future, you know, what can you possibly do to be more high tech, but also make sure that what you do keeps you involved in it and you're able to have your business or your career last. So when you were writing Excellence Dividend, how did that apply to that?
A lot of it is what I was just saying with the, you know, with the Commerce Bank or with Metro Bank. They give an example. They call themselves the Yes Bank. And that fundamentally means you need the sign off of two levels of supervisors as a frontliner before you're ever allowed to say no no to a customer. And they give this one example, which I just love. This is a first line employee at the bank, and a customer calls, and there's been a problem with the system, with MasterCard's system, and the customer is desperate. She or he is taking their family on an international trip, and it's one of those damnable airline offers where you save $3,000 if you make the deal before 4 p.m. today, and you lose the whole darn thing if you don't. So the bank employee takes the family's tickets and puts them on her personal credit card. Now, she obviously, with the client's permission, gets reimbursed as soon as possible. But that sort of initiative is the kind of thing that I'm talking about. And the answer is, yeah, that's an extreme case, but the attitude isn't extreme. We will go to any length to humanize this service. And I believe, as I say, it can be done. I mean, for heaven's sakes, when, you know, the Commerce Bank was East Coast U.S. and it embarrassed the heck out of Chase Manhattan and a whole bunch of other retailers, then they go to the U.K., and the Brits are a little bit more quiet and sedate than Americans tend to be, and everybody said, well, you can't bring this darn thing to the United Kingdom. When they do a branch opening, they have 2,000 or 3,000 people show up, and they turn it into a circus. And so you start with this incredibly committed, excited customer base, and you do use every piece of technology known to humankind to help those people with their financial management, but you humanize the whole thing. And when a glitch comes, and you know this 100 times better than I, and particularly since we have this aging audience like me, with an insane amount of money, and, you know, given God's blessing, we're living a lot longer than our parents' generation did, they are taking to technology, but they're not going to take to it instinctively. You know, I've got a son who's 33, and he's in the social media business. And when he's trying to help me with a computer problem, he's always incredibly impatient because he can't believe how stupid I am. And you know, he's got a point at some level. But you know, particularly in thinking of your entire financial management thing, we have what? 80 million boomers, and they are dying slowly. Right. And on top of that, the number that blew me away as a result, maybe not at the CEO level, but as a result of women moving through and up the managerial ranks, plus the favor that we males do to our spouses of statistically dying 7 years earlier than they do, 22 trillion dollars will be transferred to women in the next 5 years. And, you know, holy smokes, what an opportunity. And that's a perfect example, too, what we're talking about, because relative to financial decisions, the evidence is crystal clear. Women look at financial decisions in a significantly different way than men do. And they're much more focused on the family and maybe a bit more conservative, and so on. And, you know, as I say, the two biggest marketing opportunities on earth are the women's market and the old folks market. When I'm giving my speeches, the line I use is, we old folks don't have the money. We have all the money. And yet all the evidence says that 50, 60, 70% or 10 or 15 or 20% of marketing effort maximum goes into dealing with these people who have de facto, de jure, all the money.
So that's really something. You know, I think we're, as an industry, you know, the financial industry is just so ripe for disruption, and trying to figure out how to get this right, you know, how to blend high tech and high touch, how to figure out how to make the end customer, the client, the consumer feel like you're listening to them and you build a relationship with them.
You know, I think the advantage you've got, and as I understand what you guys are up to, is the advantage the people you work with have, is the giant financial institutions are going gaga over technology, and they are spending an extra $1 trillion on technology this year and getting rid of as many people as fast as possible in pursuing infinite improvement in efficiency only. And I think they are leaving a hole that is a million miles wide for financial services people who help their customers by being incredibly technologically savvy, but also being savvy about who the person is that they're serving. And God, you know, I used to talk about this a lot, and I did with financial services company. The two things that are critical to the mental health and well-being of the average human being are their financial position and their health position. And there's nothing, I mean, financial services at the retail level or at the small business level is the personal business, along with, you know, what your doctor's doing for you. And
right.
You know, missing that is just missing such an insane opportunity.
How do you think technology has affected what you do? I mean, the book writing and speaking and those kind of things. How does that affect what you
do
every day?
Well, what you and I are doing today is one example of that. Prior to this year, my last book was in 2011, and social media was around, but it wasn't the same dominant force. My book came out on April the 3rd, and my publicity, instead of running around the country or running around the world, has been podcast after podcast after podcast after podcast. And, you know, the opportunity to reach your extraordinary audience this morning is one example of that. I use Twitter a bit like a maniac. And so, and to our bigger point, I learn from it at least as much as I give to it. So social media is front and center in my life and in my thinking.
Kind of blows me away that we live in a time when we have a podcast for communicating with our team, but because it's online, it's now worldwide. We've got 350 subscribers in Tokyo, Japan. I didn't know they even had that many people who spoke English over there, but they could listen to this podcast, and the next thing you know, they could go to Amazon Japan and buy your book to learn more about what we're talking about. You know, when you wrote In Search of Excellence, that just revolutionized the business world. And the whole idea of business excellence is something that I learned in school. And at the time, you know, when you wrote that book, American businesses were just getting beat up by foreign competition, and they kind of got lost. And today, I think that main threat is technology. So you always say, in order for a workforce to rise against the threat posed by technology, that the leaders have to embrace this whole idea of high touch or embrace the humanity of the people they work with. Tell me more about that.
Well, the one thing I would say, and I will go back if it's not inappropriate to our conversation prior to the starting this and your Jesuit education, and I think Jesuit Sure. education is pretty darned amazing, is one of the things I argue in the book is every business leader, and I mean somebody with a three-person company or a six-person training department or what have you, in 2018 and beyond, every leader has a moral responsibility to help the people who work for them grow. If I work on a project for you, a temp project, a technology-driven project, if I work on a project for you for only 9 weeks, I should walk out of that experience better prepared for the future than I was 9 weeks ago. And I, you know, I'm not suggesting that we ought to introduce capital or lowercase religion into any training program, but it is a it is a lowercase r religious thing. That, you know, there's a new responsibility. People are going to get eaten alive by the new technology unless they're getting better and better at what they do involving technology and what they do involving high touch. And so, you know, I have become a screaming, shouting, arm waving old Baptist preacher, even though I was not raised a Baptist, you know, on this topic. I made a comment that people thought was and think is half insane, which is fine with me, in the book. And I said, being a manager, and this could be of a 12 person department in a 200 person division in a giant company, or a manager of a 6-person appliance repair operation near where I live, being a manager is the greatest opportunity a human being can have, because you have the chance to influence the lives over a lifetime, maybe of dozens or hundreds or even thousands of people, to influence the lives of every person who you touch, who works with you in a temporary or long-term basis. And I really believe that. There's no greater opportunity if you look at the job right. And again, that parenthetical phrase, which I must use 20 times in the book, that says, and by the way, it's the best way to grow the business, make money, and satisfy your customers and your vendors.
I totally agree. In fact, we go one step further and just take it almost as a responsibility, that it's part of why we get paid and why we have the opportunity we do, is because of what we give back to our teammates and the people that are counting on us to help us get where we need to go, like the prior generations did for me and for leaders like me over the years.
Yeah. No, I truly agree. It's right on the spec sheet. It's a requirement. And I would say, and I think there's a fair amount of evidence for this, I would say that it starts in the hiring process. You know, we refer to, I use the example of Southwest Airlines, and I was on a Southwest flight from Albany, New York to Baltimore, Washington International. It was early in the morning, and the pilots were rushing off one flight to the next flight, and the airlines are not very kind to people who are not really hustling. And so I watched the pilots hustling toward the gate where I was, and as is virtually always the case, there were half a dozen customers, passengers, who were lined up at the gate in wheelchairs. This pilot, who's under incredible pressure to be efficient, stops in front of the woman in the first wheelchair and looked at her with a smile and said, "Would you mind if I took you down the jetway?" I figure I've been on 7,500 flight legs. I had never seen anything like it. As one person in a seminar said to me when I gave that example, he said, "I've never even seen a pilot look at anybody in the customer line." Now, why does that happen? A principal reason, if not the principal reason it happens, and this comes from the former Southwest Airlines president, Colleen Barrett, is she says, we look for listening, caring, smiling, saying thank you, and being warm in every one of our employees. And it is true for the mechanics and the pilots as it is for the people who are manning or womaning the desk. And that's, you know, if you want people who behave well toward people, hire people who behave well toward people. One guy runs a pharmaceutical company, high-tech biotech company, and he says, we only hire nice people. And he said, look, this is the world's most sophisticated business. But he said, there are a bunch of PhDs out there who got bioscience degrees. Don't hire the jerks. Hire the people who, you know, really can be positive, help build teamwork. And he said, they're the ones who will turn into the innovators. And I believe that. And so, you know, some Google guy who was a senior guy said, if you gave me a dollar of resources, I would spend 70 cents of that dollar on hiring.
Well, you said in one of your books that you should look for people that, you know, as far as attributes, people that know how to listen and people that care and people that smile and people that say thank you and are warm and have enthusiasm. And you know, part of what we do here is team building. I think you probably remember that. And you also say that we shouldn't just gravitate towards the noisy ones, that could be a big mistake.
Yeah, absolutely. This book changed my life. It changed my life at a, you know, as a very old man. And Susan Cain, who incidentally is trained as a lawyer, which is interesting, wrote a book with a one word title, and the title is Quiet, Q-U-I-E-T. And, you know, she points out that 40 or 50% of those of us who inhabit the planet are introverts, not extroverts.
Right.
And I mean, I really, really, really am guilty. As I said to her when I met her, you really called me the biggest jerk in the world in that book, though you didn't mean it personally. And she shows this ton of research that says if you're noisy, you are thought to be more physically attractive, more intelligent, better team players, and it's just not true. And in fact, she argues pretty darn persuasively that it is the quiet ones who are more likely to listen. And she makes a wonderful case, going back to our prior discussion point, and she makes this wonderful case in the hiring process. You know, when you're typically asked a question in the hiring process, you immediately fire back with your brilliant, well-practiced response. She said, when you ask somebody a question in the hiring process and they stop and they actually pause for 45 seconds, it doesn't mean they're stupid or unprepared. It means, God help us, that they're thinking. I have, you know, I probably on the page where I read that story, and I read the book in paper form, I bet you could still find the spit marks from how hard I was laughing.
That's really something. Well, you know, another thing you said is that curiosity, this amazing word, could be called the number one way we individually and collectively differentiate ourselves in this modern age. How do we learn how to ask more questions?
Well, I'm not going to stick on this too much. Two things. A, we hire for curiosity and listening. And you will see it, or the absence thereof, in an interviewing process, A. B, listening is trainable. Listening, as I say it in the book, is no different than learning to play the cello or learning to code. There's a listening instinct. I would not deny that for a minute. And for one thing, there are gender differences, and women are more likely to listen effectively than men are. But nonetheless, training is possible. Training is helpful. You can be trained in asking questions. I mean, there, you know, two comments. One is the great, inimitable, incredible entrepreneur, businessman, Richard Branson, wrote a management book. It was his first management book, and if my memory serves me correctly, it was 325 pages long. And the first section in the book, which was 115 pages, was on listening. And Branson said, we have 8 attributes of effective managers, and every one of the 8 is based on listening skills. So you can select for it, you can train it, you can train people how to ask questions. A variation on the theme, which is a little crosswise to what you're saying, is a friend of mine, he just sold it, had a very successful NGO, non-governmental organization, and they were involved in a lot of engineering projects, and a lot of it was in so-called third world countries. And he said, I needed engineers, but he said, I never hired anybody who didn't have some outside passion. And the outside passion could be growing roses, or the outside passion could be collecting model railroad trains. But he said, I wanted some indication that the person had some horizontal breadth beyond their narrow technical skill. And I thought that was just terrific. He said you wouldn't believe the number of things I've learned about roses and model railroads, which has also been fun.
Thanks for listening to Leadership Now, the official podcast of WealthWave. If you like our show and you want to know more, check out wealthwave.com/podcast, or you can leave us a review on iTunes. Join us each week as we talk about the topics you'll need to help you grow as an entrepreneur and succeed in the financial business with WealthWave.